As I've gotten older, it's become more and more important to me that I support my immune system and digestion. I'm always looking for a supplement that's not only good for my body, but tastes good too. That's where Equilibria Daily Nutrigreens comes in. Equilibria is a woman-owned wellness brand with unique science-backed products that help bring your mind and body back into harmony. Daily Nutrigreens contain an immune antioxidant and detox blend, along with prebiotics, probiotics, and over 35 fruits and vegetables. These greens are great because they're the quickest way to fill in your daily nutritional gaps, and it tastes good. Equilibria makes it easy to meet your nutritional goals. You can subscribe so you don't have to worry about running out, and you get 25% off each month. Head to myeq.com and use code RAIN for 15% off Equilibria's daily Nutrigreens and much more. That's myeq.com and use code RAIN at checkout for 15% off site-wide today.
This is Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Jackson County, Oregon, is one of the southernmost counties in the state. The county has a few very notable things that if you happen to be traveling to Oregon, you might want to check out. Up first is Bear Creek Greenway. This is a paved biking and hiking path that stretches over 20 miles and runs all the way from Ashland, Oregon to Central Point, Oregon. The famous Pacific Crest Trail, or PCT, has been featured in both the book and movie Wild, and of course, Gilmore Girls, A Year in the Life. Shout out to Josh's dad. The trail stretches 2,653 miles, or 4,270 kilometers for our non-American listeners, and it passes through Oregon and, of course, Jackson County, as well as the states California and Washington. And it goes through 25 national forests and 7 national parks. Many folks just complete a small stretch at a time, but of course, the most hardcore of hikers will attempt the entire stretch at once, and that's known as through hiking. Only the most bold will attempt that feat and become one of the esteemed hikers that complete the journey, which is estimated at taking between 4 and 6 months to complete. The completion rate of those that attempt through hiking is roughly 14%. So very few people actually do that. Side note, I just thought that was fun.
Yeah. Brutal.
Then, of course, there's the world famous Shakespeare Festival in Ashland, Oregon. The festival goes from April through December and features multiple performances per day, multiple days per week. Nearly 400,000 people attend the festival each year, and it's been going on since 1935. For the people who want to get a little bit weirder on their visit to Oregon, Jackson County has stuff for you, too. There's, of course, the Bigfoot Trap located in the Siskiyou National Forest. It's thought to be the world's only Bigfoot trap.
Oh.
It's been in place since 1974 and has since become a staple for tourists. Another staple of the Oregon roadside attraction circuit that is located in Jackson County is the Oregon Vortex near Sardine Creek in Gold Hill, Oregon.
I love it there.
The site features several optical illusions that have drawn hundreds of thousands of tourists, making it one of the most successful Oregon roadside attractions of all time.
Can I throw in a fun fact?
Sure you can.
That is the basis of the cartoon Gravity Falls.
Yes, it is. And I didn't put that in here, but I did know that. The man that developed the area in the 1920s believed that the property was on the site of a spherical force field that was partially beneath and above the ground. The Oregon Vortex draws all sorts of people, from regular tourists to psychics, to those desperate for a medical miracle such as relieving their lifelong back pain. As if I didn't give you enough reasons to visit this area in southern Oregon, I'll top it off by saying it's just utterly beautiful there. The county, which sits above the border of California, is surrounded by forests and mountains. It's easy to get there taking the I-5, and everywhere you look is lush. That being said, it's a mixed bag for a lot of people when it comes to livability. Some of the larger cities in the area are known for heavy drug use and crime, and some of the small towns aren't exactly welcoming to those who may be different from the locals, not our listeners, of course. That being said, Ashland, Oregon is rather liberal and has always been a draw for local and distant artists. How could an artist not be inspired by such a gorgeous location? But it's not just artists who are drawn there. Sometimes folks just want to retire somewhere rural, or they need a break from the constant go, go, go of their everyday life. And that's where today's story begins. The beauty of Jackson County, Oregon, doesn't make it much different from some of the more populated counties in Oregon, or even throughout the United States. Like other rural areas, the amount of property crime is much higher than the nationwide average. And while violent crime isn't as prevalent, there's still roughly 15 incidents of violent crime per 1,000 people, which is slightly less than the national average. But something like homicide will give the locals whiplash, as it isn't something they hear about every day. But it does happen. In today's case, we explore a real whodunit in a little unincorporated community in Jackson County called Applegate, Oregon. In 2016, a shocking crime would take place on a local ranch and leave folks reeling when they learned that their little community could be the backdrop for a soon-to-be infamous crime. On July 26, 2016, a 911 call was made to the Jackson County Sheriff's Office. On the line was a woman who said she was a notary on a job at a ranch in Applegate. While she was there working with a family to get some paperwork signed, there was a dispute and she heard a gun go off. She told police that a male had been shot and was laying outside the front door, but she wasn't planning to go anywhere near him. The man was 63-year-old Shane Moore. Shane lived on the property with several other people. There were two houses which sat nearby on the property. In one was his mother, sister, and niece, and in the other was Shane and his two roommates. When the gunshot the woman described went off, Shane's roommate Carlton heard it and rushed from Shane's house next door over to the other house where Shane lay injured. With the help of the 911 operator, Carlton started CPR. When first responders got to the property, they found Shane lying outside the front door of the main house on the property. Unfortunately, the CPR was unsuccessful, and Shane passed away due to a single gunshot wound to the chest. Police began to investigate the scene, and for once, this isn't a story where investigators were bending over backwards searching for witnesses. This time, there were several people present on the property at the time of the shooting, and they'd be able to share all of the details. The notary who called in the shooting was Carla Treiber. She had fled the scene after she made the call, fearing for her own safety. Left behind were Kelly Moore, Shane's sister, Lori Moore, Shane's elderly mother, and Tucker Moore Reed, Shane's niece. They all lived in the main house. Also present was Carlton Olison, Shane's roommate, who I mentioned ran over from the other house on the property where he lived with Shane. The property is a 150-acre ranch, and it was originally purchased in the year 2000 by Shane's mother and father. After a few months of living there, their daughter Kelly moved into the house with her teenage daughters after her recent divorce. When Shane and Kelly's father was diagnosed with ALS soon thereafter, Shane also moved to the property to help care for him. He moved into a separate house with multiple roommates to help offset the costs of running the ranch. Eventually, Kelly and Shane's father died, and they both remained to care for their mother and the property. The Moore family isn't some boring little ranch family. They have a very unique background, so let's do a bit of a rundown. Shane Patrick Moore was one of five children born to Lundy Addison Moore and his wife Lori Moore in 1953. Shane, bright like most of his family, opted to go to law school in California, where he did very well. But like many folks, he quickly learned that it just wasn't for him, and instead he opened a successful bookstore. As I mentioned, when his dad got sick, he abandoned the life he had built for himself to put his parents first. Instead of running his own store, he did odd jobs, cared for his father up until his death, and remained on the property to care for his mother as well as ensure that the ranch was in working order and making money. Kelly Moore was born 3 years after her brother in Manchester Township, New Jersey. Eventually, she followed her brother to California, where she also opted to go to law school. She completed her schooling and quickly became a high-powered lawyer. Kelly married a man named Daniel Reed, who was an actor and screenwriter. Eventually, the pair would venture into the creative world together when they co-authored a true crime bestseller called Deadly Medicine, which was based on the Texas nurse Janine Jones. Interestingly enough, I covered that case on our Patreon episode called Death Shift. A quick synopsis is that Janine Jones worked at Bexar County Medical Center in Texas in the 1980s. Over the course of multiple years, there was a major spike in pediatric deaths, and there were rumors that one particular shift had more deaths than any other. And that shift featured one, Janine Jones, whom colleagues had growing concerns over. Lo and behold, the rumors were validated, but it took years to get this woman behind bars. And of course, like other dramatic cases, there were possible cover-ups, including records being shredded, making things all the harder to button up. While Jones was suspected of killing roughly 60 children, she was only convicted of a few of those murders. She's in prison today, but could possibly get parole in her old age, as her plea deal gives her the possibility of parole at the age of 87. Now back to Kelly. She was a gifted writer who helped investigate that case, and she married a gifted actor and screenwriter. The pair went on to have three gifted children, Ashlyn, Larkin, and St. John. By 1998, Kelly left her job as a lawyer and decided to support her children full time, in particular, Ashlyn, who was now going by the name Tucker. Tucker took after her father and was a natural at acting, so her mom stopped working so that she could help Tucker pursue her dreams. In the year 2000, Kelly and Dan divorced, so Kelly decided to move in with her parents, who recently relocated to the ranch in Southern Oregon. It wasn't just Dad that Tucker Moore Reed took after. Yes, she loved to act and was often partaking in school plays at her high school in Ashland, Oregon, and in the community theater as well. When she wasn't acting, she was designing sets and costumes. But like her mother, Tucker also had a knack for writing. She was a reporter and editor for her school newspaper, and eventually, at the age of 19 in 2009, she convinced her mother to collaborate on a young adult novel called Amber House with her and her sister Larkin. The book got published in 2012 and went on to get them a six-figure three-book deal with Scholastic Press. In 2010, Reed, now a budding author, was accepted to the University of California, where she opted to study broadcast journalism, theater, and cinema. Similar to high school, she reported for the university paper and was also the assistant editor. While it seemed like Tucker led an exciting and perhaps perfect life, not everything was great for her. In college, she had a boyfriend who she claimed one night took things too far, and after repeatedly pressuring her for sex, he ended up raping her. She went to the police and the USC Student Judicial Affairs in 2013 to report the crime. Both parties rejected her case, claiming that the burden of proof was not met. So she turned to her writing and detailed the crime in a blog. This resulted in a ton of media attention, as USC had other similar cases going on at the time. Unfortunately, this attention didn't allow Tucker to make much progress in her case. What ended up occurring was a defamation suit filed against her. That didn't stop her from trying to create change. She created a campus coalition called SCAR, or Student Coalition Against Rape, where she could help bring awareness about campus rape to the public. She was even recognized by the Veteran Feminists of America and won the Lucy Burns Challenger Award for her activism. Tucker eventually dropped out of USC, but that didn't hinder her success. She wrote for several publications, including Cosmopolitan Magazine, ExoJane.com, and the Huffington Post. Eventually, she moved back in with her mother and grandmother and started working as a reporter in Southern Oregon while still pursuing her dreams of acting. Once police arrived at the ranch on July 26, 2016, to investigate the shooting death of Shane Moore, they quickly learned that this was not one big happy family living and thriving together. It seemed that the childhood rivalry that occurred between Kelly and Shane as kids reignited when they began living on the ranch together. In fact, that was part of the reason the notary was there that day. Once investigators tracked Carla Treiber down to interview her and talk to other witnesses, they started to piece together the family dynamics, and it wasn't pretty. The notary, Carla, told investigators that she had been contacted by Shane Moore regarding their property. She had come to the appointment that day with a quitclaim deed. An Oregon quitclaim deed is a written instrument that essentially details a property owner's current interest in Oregon real estate. This deed, when signed by Lori Moore, would have everyone in agreement that upon her death, the property would be split 50-50 between Kelly and Shane. Prior to this, there had been a lot of contention between the siblings about the property. It seemed like Kelly wanted to get the most money out of it, and Shane just wanted to split things evenly and move on with his life. They argued because Kelly wanted to log the property for money, but Shane didn't want to remove the trees because it would affect the value of the property when they chose to sell it, which is what he wanted to do after his mother passed. According to Carla, when she arrived, she was seated at the dining room table with Lori and Kelly, and Kelly's daughter Tucker was also in the room. As they reviewed the paperwork, Shane was standing outside of the house looking into the dining room through the window. Kelly ended up getting upset because she thought they were there to discuss changes to her mother's will. But when she learned that the paperwork was really a grant deed, she refused to have her mother sign it and ultimately ripped the paperwork up right in front of the notary. Shane apparently, after watching this through the window, attempted to walk in through the front door. At this point, Kelly and Tucker walked towards the door to prevent him from coming inside. This is when Carla heard the gun go off. Unfortunately, she said she didn't see who was holding it or how it happened. Once the gun went off and she realized someone had been hurt, she dialed 911. She then immediately left the scene. Investigators had their interview work cut out for them, knowing there were so many people on the property that day, but Carla cleared one thing up for them, and that was Carlton, Shane's roommate, was not in the room with them that day. When the gunshot went off and she dialed 911, Carlton ran over from the other residents to attempt to save Shane's life. He was not present when the gun went off and was quickly cleared as a suspect. But now the real work would begin, as detectives had to interview the family. They sat down with 59-year-old Kelly Moore and were able to align Carla's sequence of events with Kelly's, but then they got a whole lot more. Very quickly, Kelly began to villainize her older brother. She was adamant that the only reason Shane moved into the property was to secure his bag, that when his mother died, he would have established himself as one of the final people caring for her, as he did for his father, because he was a mooch. He wanted their money. In fact, he was already exploiting them and their ranch. According to Kelly, Shane was using drugs while living on their mother's property. She believed he was growing marijuana and possibly even making meth. She claimed that her mother had her and her daughter move there because her mother was afraid of Shane. What's interesting about that is Kelly moved there first and then her daughter.
Oh.
And then her daughter went to college and came back. And then Shane moved there to take care of his father. So
Doesn't exactly line up.
It doesn't line up. But I also couldn't get a perfect clarification on when his father died, because it looks like all their information has been removed from many of the websites we use.
Gotcha.
But it doesn't add up, I think. I could see in the interview, because there is some video online, that she was very riled up and frustrated. So it might not be logical what she was saying there.
Yeah.
As Kelly detailed this potential drug habit and possible career her brother may have been involved in, she went as far as to draw a map of the ranch for police to show them where she believed these things were happening. She also told police about an alarming recent situation. That previous September, there was a family dispute. Shane had been leaving the property when he and his niece Tucker got into an argument. While they argued, Shane threw a plastic quart of oil at Tucker through a doorway, and it ended up hitting her in the face and leaving enough damage to scar her.
Jeez.
Her and her mother called police, and a criminal case ensued. Shane ended up being charged with fourth-degree assault, and the court issued a no-contact order between him and Tucker. And that's kind of hard when you live on the same property. But the point was, they're supposed to avoid each other and not engage with each other. Kelly went on to tell police that Shane desperately wanted them to drop the charges and that he was continually issuing threats against them until Tucker did so. Tucker never dropped the charges, which means at the time of Shane's shooting, there was a no contact order in place between them. Kelly created what she thought was a good solution, knowing that Shane's biggest fear was losing inheritance from his mother. She wanted to change her mother's will to add language stating that if anything happened to her mother, her family, or damages to the property caused by Shane, it would disinherit him automatically. She claimed that Shane had already caused damage to their car since they all lived on the same property. She believed that by adding this language, they could all get what they want and live peacefully. And it kind of is a nice thought.
Yeah.
If he really is the problem. When confronted by police regarding the notary witnessing Kelly getting visibly upset over the paperwork being a grant deed and not a will, Kelly described that Shane had asked the notary to prepare a grant deed to ensure the property was split evenly between them. And that's what really set her off. She had thought that her solution would have appeased everyone. But yet again, Shane was making the situation harder than it needed to be. And that's what caused her to rip up the grant deed into four pieces. Kelly then went on to describe how after she ripped up the deed, Shane tried to force his way into the residence and that the pair of them were fighting at the door, pushing the door back and forth, him trying to get entry into the house and her trying to keep him out. So far, the interview was going as well as it could be. The detectives were gaining a full understanding of the intense dynamic between the Moore family. However, that wasn't long lived. As Kelly described the confrontation at the front door, she abruptly stopped and told them that's as much as she was going to say. That was the end of her statement. I mean, you watch this video of her talking and she's just blah, 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 blah. And then I'm done. That's it. It's very abrupt. Where,
like, she realized what she was doing?
Well, or... she told the entire story up until there being involvement of a gun.
Oh, okay.
When it came time to interview Tucker, detectives turned up the pressure. They urged her to tell them everything because she was the one witness they really needed to hear from. She obliged. She validated the conversation that happened over the table, that her mother got upset after learning her uncle Shane brought the notary to the property with the deed and not the will. She explained that her uncle had hurt her months prior and that she had pressed charges resulting in a no contact order that he was constantly trying to break. This regular boundary pushing Shane was doing made her fear for her and her mother's safety. And she explained that earlier that day, she had found her grandfather's gun in the house. That morning, she took it outside to see if it was loaded and fired a shot from the porch. That's how I check if guns are loaded, too. After realizing, yep, it's loaded, she claimed she gave the gun to her mother, who then put it in the kitchen under a napkin. This was just in case things didn't go as planned at the notary appointment and that they needed to protect themselves.
That's
What does that say to you? Just first.
That says, I anticipate this going poorly.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to be armed because I'm probably going to have to shoot someone.
Which may be premeditated.
Yeah.
If you think about it long enough.
I'm there.
Yeah. Tucker went on to say that once her mother and Shane got into it over the torn up deed, she began to worry for her mother's safety. She grabbed the gun from beneath the napkin in the kitchen, walked towards the door where she saw her uncle pushing in the door and reaching in with his arm, attempting to grab her mother. She then fired the gun by accident, claiming that she mistakenly thought you had to cock a gun before it would fire.
Then why are you pulling the trigger?
Yeah. There you have it. A confession. 26-year-old Tucker Moore Reed admitted that she was the one who killed her uncle, albeit by accident. After her confession, the same day of Shane's death, July 26, 2016, Tucker was arrested for manslaughter, which is, of course, murder without intent. With Tucker in custody, investigators went back to the ranch with a search warrant. They collected all of the paperwork that the notary brought to the house, including the ripped up deed. They collected the gun, which was sitting on a console table just beside the front door. As they continued to investigate the case and evaluate all the evidence, 3 days after her arrest, Tucker Moore was let out on bail. Her mother spoke to the press to ensure that everyone knew her daughter was protecting her from her uncle and that she acted in self-defense. When the gun was eventually analyzed, it showed that only a single round had been used, meaning it had been fully loaded when it fired at Shane. This conflicted with Tucker's story.
Yeah.
She had claimed that she fired one shot earlier in the day, then another when it killed her uncle. So this would mean she either lied and only one shot was fired, or the bullet had been reloaded so that the gun was fully loaded just in case for later.
Mm-hmm.
So this made detectives wonder if Tucker's story regarding Shane being shot in self-defense was truthful. Now that investigators had some evidence that was leading them to believe self-defense may not have been a factor, they were looking for additional information to help piece together what actually happened. On August 1st, 5 days after the incident, Shane's other roommate, Stacy McKenzie, contacted police. Stacy had an existing warrant, so when police came to the property the day of Shane's death, she avoided them. Now, however, she felt compelled to share the information she had. Stacy came down to the station to give her statement. According to her, Shane was the one who was scared for his life, not Kelly and Tucker. Stacy claimed that the day that Shane died, he had actually told her he was afraid for his life. Stacy went on to share that Kelly was incredibly greedy and only wanted money. Kelly hadn't worked in over 10 years and was living off of her parents, unlike Shane, who actually worked on the ranch. According to her, Kelly thought Shane coming to live with her parents to care for them was really just so that he could secure her inheritance. The property was worth upwards of $3 million. Stacy shared that once his mother died, Shane had planned to move out, sell the property, split the proceeds evenly, and leave Kelly behind. Shane had asked his mother to update the deed so that it was clear to everyone that him and Kelly would split the property evenly, and he would be able to easily go on his way after that, which his mother apparently agreed to. The day that Shane was shot, Stacy claimed she heard the gunshot, followed by screams, and went bolting from the home she shared with Shane and Carlton. As she approached the other residents, she saw Shane lying on the ground, writhing in pain, and Tucker was standing over him, holding a gun and yelling at him, "Just die." Then she says she heard Kelly screaming out the door, "What do you mean he's not dead yet?" She said blood was pouring out of Shane's nose and mouth. Stacy said that no one was helping Shane other than Carlton. In fact, Kelly came out, stood over Shane and said, "Haven't you died yet, you piece of shit? Why aren't you dead yet?" Stacy had the full belief that Kelly and Tucker had stashed the gun in the kitchen with the intent of killing Shane later that day. She believed it was, quote, cold-blooded, calculated murder. As investigators looked deeper into the case at the Moore residence, they learned that there was more than one 911 call made from the ranch that day. At 1:40 p.m. on July 26th, Shane Moore had called police to report that his niece fired a gun to threaten him. Shane explained that he had a notary public coming within the hour and he didn't want there to be any trouble when she got there. He then requested that a sheriff come out to the property as a precaution. Unfortunately, the Jackson County Sheriff didn't come as they don't typically get involved in cases like this, you know, civil cases, which is really unfortunate because he foresaw what was going to happen. To gain additional perspective on this dynamic between Kelly and Shane, detectives called some of their siblings. They learned from Ryan Moore, their brother who lives in Northern California, that Kelly and Shane had a falling out and it was because of Kelly. Ryan detailed that Kelly was manipulative and arrogant. He also believed that she, quote, bled her parents dry. While Shane didn't have a job, he took care of the expansive property and was a hard worker and overall a gentle person. Ryan said that he was never violent or aggressive. However, his sister Kelly always had a heinous temper. At one point, Ryan confronted Kelly about taking advantage of their parents. When he did so, Kelly flew into a rage and charged at him with a fire poker. Ryan went on to say that Tucker was very much like her mother, having, quote, crazy rages frequently. After speaking with Ryan, authorities were confident that Kelly and Tucker were lying, but they still needed proof. Roughly 6 months into the investigation, detectives received a call from the district attorney. They were letting them know that Tucker's attorney reached out to inform them that there is video from the day of Shane's death, video that Tucker had filmed from her own cell phone. Now, you might wonder, why didn't the police look at her phone when she was first arrested? Well, they wanted to, but they never got the passcode to the phone and apparently proceeded in the case without any potential evidence that could have come out of that device. Now, I have to think that's because the original charge was manslaughter and they didn't really see a point because they had her confession, but it's still kind of frustrating. I mean, Some of them had to have thought at the time that maybe it was premeditated and maybe, just maybe, there was evidence on her personal device.
Yeah, at the very least, just take the steps to make sure there isn't.
Right. But I guess it's too much of a hassle to go through the legal steps to do that with the phone company when you have a confession, you know? I get it, I guess, but boy. Anyway, Tucker believed that this video would prove that she acted in self-defense, allowing her to stay out of jail. We'll play the audio for you now, and you can view the video originally posted by the Oregonian in our episode blog.
Oh, this is a grantee.
So do you know him?
Oh, this is not his son.
Do you know him?
No. It was not his son.
This man, my Uncle Shane, came into... That's a squatter here. Okay. He squats here. And Shane is supposed to stay and take care of my grandmother. And the other day... He has assaulted me.
In the video, you can hear Tucker narrating as she pans across the window where you see Shane standing outside.
Yes, this man.
She goes on to say, quote, "This man threatened this woman, my mother, unless she signs the paper." All he's doing is standing there. Then you see Kelly, her mother, and the notary discussing the paperwork across the table.
She was told it was an inheritance, a will.
An addendum to her will.
A will. This is a grantee. You're not signing a grantee, mother.
No, I understand.
Tucker screams.
He's coming into the house. God damn it.
Pick up the gun. Shane sounds calm when he begins to talk to Kelly through the door, but Kelly yells that her mother is not signing the grant deed. The entire time, you hear Tucker yelling at Shane. Then Tucker picks up the gun, runs towards the front door. The gun goes off, and you hear Shane scream in pain and gurgle through what sounds like a mouthful of blood. Kelly is screaming as well.
Jesus!
Oh, God. She shot him. Oh, Tucker.
He wasn't supposed to be around me. He's violent and dangerous.
When detectives watched the video, they felt that it was not proving the self-defense case. They saw it as evidence supporting the case they were trying to build, that this was murder and it was planned. They were preparing to charge Tucker Reed with first-degree murder. Unfortunately, it would take over a year to push through any upgraded charges. Initially, the DA pushed back and wanted to keep the manslaughter charge. However, they were going to have to go back in front of the grand jury to revise some verbiage used in the original case, so that offered them the opportunity to upgrade the charges. Now, years into the case, it seemed like things were not looking good for Tucker. She would likely see new charges brought against her. In August of 2018, her and her legal team decided to file a complaint that, quote, she was sleep-deprived, malnourished, and suffering from withdrawals from a potent prescription medication while being questioned by Medford Police and Jackson County Sheriff's detectives following the shooting. She initially told detectives that she was physically and mentally unfit to answer their questions. The lawsuit filed was essentially claiming that she was pressured into making a statement resulting in her confession and that she was seeking damages of $50,000. The judge denied her claim. Eventually, the upgraded murder indictment was officially accepted, and on September 5th, 2018, Tucker Moore Reed was once again arrested, this time for second-degree murder. Tucker then went before a judge for a bail hearing, and the judge denied her bail. Tucker had an outburst in court over this denial and was eventually moved to the county jail. After the hearing took place, a filmmaker reached out to police. Between arrests, the first for manslaughter and the second for second-degree murder, Tucker had been cast in a horror movie called From the Dark, which filmed in Josephine County, Oregon, over the course of 5 months. The film wrapped up just before the second arrest. Tucker had responded to a Facebook post regarding auditions for the movie in April 2018. She auditioned and was cast as the lead, Valerie Faust. The role is associated with Tucker's professional name, Wynn Reed. In the film, which I happened to watch this past weekend because you can rent it for $1.99 on Apple TV, Tucker takes on the role of Valerie, a tour guide at a local cave system and chateau in Southern Oregon. Raised in the area by her late father, who also worked there, Valerie has recently decided it's time to move on from her familiar surroundings. Before her departure, Valerie's boss goes on vacation, entrusting her with the responsibility of closing up for the season. Instead of simply shutting down the chateau that evening, Valerie decides to suspend work, allowing her colleagues to leave early and join her for her farewell party in one of the cabins on the property. While they party there together, the group becomes entangled in a series of eerie occurrences and eventually grisly murders, echoing the local legends of the area they have all grown up hearing about. As the night unfolds, the boundaries between myth and reality blur, culminating in a horrifying climax of campy gore. The filmmaker learned of Tucker's arrest for murder and reached out to police, who grew interested in what he told them about the film. In particular, they wanted to see footage from a specific scene where the leading lady handles a gun and ends up shooting someone. In that scene, Valerie is armed in the dark cabin when two of her male colleagues get into a brawl as the night's stress comes to a head. When one of them, with a shady history, seemingly turns on her, the gun goes off. The filmmaker describes the scene as the character believing she's shooting someone in self-defense, but as you watch it take place, you may realize it was murder. Art imitating life?
Was this before the shooting?
This was after. So the shooting happened in 2016. She got out on bail and was just waiting for whatever court case was going to happen, got cast in the movie, filmed the movie, and then got arrested for second degree murder. So that whole time they were investigating her.
The script spoke to her, I guess.
I think it might have. Over the course of a couple of years, Tucker went through multiple attorneys, ultimately delaying her trial repeatedly. With each change in counsel, they would get extra time to read up on her case and prepare for trial. The DA was getting more and more worried that there would be someone in a jury eventually that would buy her self-defense story and that the case would just be a bust. So they offered her a deal. In May of 2020, 30-year-old Tucker finally had her selected attorney, and they opted to accept a plea deal. The deal would drop her charges to second-degree manslaughter and offer her credit for time served. This resulted in a sentence of 75 months, which means she could be released from Coffee Creek Correctional Facility in Wilsonville, where she currently resides, as early as November 25th, 2024. Prior to her plea acceptance, that January of the same year, Moore Reed was facing charges for unlawfully possessing heroin and supplying contraband while she was in Jackson County Jail. So I don't think anything has come from that. She doesn't have any charges on her account about drugs, but maybe it got dropped when she accepted her plea.
Oh, yeah, that's probably part of it.
But I think she might be a bit of a troublemaker. I don't know. The most recent activity I've read about this case was in 2021. She filed a malpractice suit against her defense attorney, claiming that he failed to adequately represent her, which resulted in her accepting a false plea. And that was, of course, dismissed by the judge. Now, if you're like me, you're probably wondering if anything happened to her mother, Kelly Moore, who may have had involvement in the planning. Investigators have alluded to wanting to charge her with conspiracy. Like, yeah, I think they truly believe she helped plan this.
Yeah.
But they never had evidence, so she didn't ever see jail time.
Wow.
Yeah. is an interesting one.
It is. It's funny you brought this one up, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's been on my list for like 2 years.
Yeah, you're so into film. That makes sense. We just never talked about it.
Yeah, there was, I think there's a, is it a Dateline that covered that or 2020?
There was a Snapped episode, and then Dateline has a podcast fully devoted to this case.
Oh, okay.
I believe it's called Killer Roll, and it's narrated by our bud, who I tried to get into it. It's a little too embellished on the, you know, like in this luscious Oregon forest, blah, blah, blah. I couldn't get into it. But I'm guessing because there's multiple episodes, it probably gets really detailed with interviews.
As far as the case goes, it's funny because on paper or before you hear more details, it makes sense.
Yeah.
You think this person has assaulted me or harmed me or threatened me. I don't feel safe around them. Nothing's happened, but I don't feel safe, so I'm going to make myself feel safe. With just that, you think, oh, man, she was being harmed by her uncle, and then he showed up. And
he's there, and you can see him in the window.
But then why are you filming? That's 90% of, like, fail videos or, you know, if I watch YouTube videos of funny stuff, and I'm like, that's funny, but why were they filming? This is obviously fake.
If it's from a security camera, that's one thing.
Right.
But why are you sitting there having my cell phone out when I see my uncle there?
Right.
Well, and then the other argument of that is she sees him standing outside loitering. She turns it on to film him. That I could understand.
I suppose,
but her narration really got me. He's coming in the house, God damn it.
Well, and just...
I'm like, what? And that's worse acting than me.
And I guess, I mean, obviously you would be saying that to the notary. You'd be saying we have issues.
Yeah.
But you would also... Actors are always the worst actors out of when they're not in a scene and they're trying to act. It's always the worst.
Yeah.
And so it really comes off of instead of, oh, my God, my uncle's here and we've had these issues. I'm really sorry. It's really you would just be explaining it. Not, well, he has an order that he is not to get near me in any way. And da 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 da.
Yeah, it was just odd that she was narrating it.
And it doesn't help that the shots are fired while she is getting heated about what the documents are.
Does she have the phone aimed at him when he's shot, or how is it?
It is panning throughout the room. So she's standing in the kitchen and she has a direct view straight ahead of her of the dining room where her grandmother and mother are sitting with the notary. And then if you slowly pan to the right, there's the window right next to the front door. Okay. And that's where you can see the uncle just watching them. And he is just casually standing there. To me, it looks like someone who is like, I know I can't be in there, but I'm interested to see how this goes.
And I know I can't trust them to not try
exactly.
to fuck with
it. Exactly. And then he watches her rip up the document and knows his sister's about to go into a rage. And he comes in my opinion, calmly tries to say something. Mm-hmm. And then they're just swarming him. And then you see the phone kind of jostling around because Tucker's holding it, grabs the gun, and it's just kind of flying around in motion as that gun goes off. And you're just hearing things at that point. For me, there are pieces of it that, yes, logically, that makes sense in this situation that it is self-defense, right? Like,
right.
You could explain the gun accidentally going off. You could explain the background of your uncle hurting you, blah, blah, blah. But putting it all together and then having a video to watch and listen to, it's just...
How many times do we have to hear something so awful for something so stupid? You're willing to let your child rot in prison... Potentially forever. She could have been given the death penalty or been.
So you could get your bag. So you could get the whole property.
So you get some land.
And that's what kills me is that.
To get some land. To get a house.
I have to assume she got the whole property. And that's what really, really kills me is she got what she wanted. And she didn't care. Her daughter's getting, you know, she's taking care of it for her. That is the type of person her family described, her brother described.
That's so foul.
Moms, huh?
That's the stuff that feels hopeless. It's not, oh, there's these horrible people doing horrible things. Like, that is awful, and we do need to combat those. But it's one thing to try to help people who maybe have mental health issues or drug issues or whatever it is that's leading to these choices. How do you cure greed? How do you cure narcissism? How do you cure
it? You can't.
Exactly.
That's the thing about it.
And that to me is so much more horrifying, and not that they're different, but it's a different kind of monster. It's not the guy who's lurking in the corner that's going to grab you that you have to be looking out for. It's your own family.
Yeah, it's really sad. And she didn't have any hope the way, you know, that was her person growing up. So she molded her. I have to think she had contributed.
That's what it sounds like. And again, this is obviously just on what you're telling me and don't know these people. But yeah, I kind of got this feeling of this insidious, it's about us and we're going to get what we want.
I agree. And the other thing that struck me is her mother. I mean, she, I think, was like 86 or 90 or something. You can tell she's just, okay, I'll do what you want, sitting there. And that's why she didn't want her brother near her.
Honestly, that part when they were talking, I was like, oh, yeah.
I
hear some family members in that.
Yeah.
I hear those conversations with Grampy. And how many times, Josh, have we referenced Fargo? All of that, so many people dead. And for what? For a little bit of money. And it's a beautiful day. Your daughter's in prison. Your brother's dead. So that you could have a little farm. That's sick.
Yeah.
And then she gets out. She'll just go live with her mom on the farm.
Well, I mean, she had that 3-book deal. And I don't, you know, and as sad as it is in America,
they probably
she has pen name. She has a pen name. She has a professional name. Like, nobody's going to know. They're just like a young adult book. Yeah.
Tucker has, she's a writer now?
She wrote with, in 2009.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
She convinced her mother to co-author a book with her and her sister. And it became a very successful young adult book. Got a 3-book deal. So I think she could easily go right back into that. She's an articulate young woman.
I might look into that. I might see.
I'm going to read it.
If there's still a deal. Might ask Scholastic about that.
Well, 2 of the books are out. I don't know if the 3rd one ever got made.
Right.
Does she have a different pen name than her acting name and her real name?
Yeah. I don't know, but here are some of her aliases.
You know, that's always a little suspicious to me.
All right. Well, some of them.
Do you know how many aliases I have?
So first of all,
Joshy.
Ashlyn.
2.
Ashlyn, her name is spelled A-I-S-L-I-N-G. So anyway, there's Ashlyn Reed with 2 E's, Ashlyn Moore Reed, again with 2 E's, Tucker Reed, Tucker Moore Reed with an R-E-A-D, Wynn Reed is her acting name. And those are the ones I know of. I did not look up the book to see what the pen name is in there. I promise I will because I will be reading it. But I'll get back to you on that. Well, I want to know where Tucker came from. I like the name Ashlyn. I think, and I would like it if it was pronounced the way it was spelled too. Ashling.
Ashling.
Aisling.
Aisling. I think Aisling actually is a cool name.
Yeah, Josh, I'm with you on that. Anytime.
It's questionable.
Usually.
Why do you have a persona? Why do you have
usually
an alter
a reality
ego?
Show? Or...
Well, I get it with actors though.
Yeah, no, but I think there's a personality. It's one thing to have nicknames or things like that, but the people that say, don't get me a drink because then so-and-so's coming out.
Fernando's coming out.
Yeah, I can't. Oh, my God, Fernando. I can't help that thing because I was being so-and-so because I was in a mood. And it's like, no, you need to own this. And also, like, what? I'm with you on that, Josh, where it's that's a red flag for me. Definitely. Not that I didn't go by AJ and Allie in elementary school.
Well, I went by Nikki with 2 K's all of 3rd grade, and I made my uncle call me that, and I wouldn't respond until he called me that, and he eventually started calling me that.
Well, and again, that's kid stuff. That makes sense. You're trying to figure out and do. I don't know.
I was also obsessed with my friend Hannah's name since it was the same front going forward or backwards, you know, the spelling, and I just thought that was the coolest thing. That's like the only thing I remember about her, except for the fact that she had like really dark brown hair, straight, pretty hair that she always wore in 2 braids.
Wow. Shout out to Hannah with the 2 braids.
And the 2 H's. And the 2 A's and the 2 N's.
Ah!
It just gets better and better.
If I were to spell her name, I'd put a braid on either H
yes,
at the end.
Absolutely you would.
Just hanging that, down.
The part is the A-N-N-A. Absolutely. I visualize it now.
Hannah's scalp.
Was the site of a spherical, some of the larger cities, some of the larger city, I almost did it again.
Cicadas.
Have you guys been to any of the Ashlyn stuff?
I haven't. I wanted to go to the Shakespeare Festival. I thought that'd be fun.
That surprises me that you haven't gone there, Em. That seems like something that'd be kind of up your alley.
I avoid Southern
Oregon.
There's a Shell station right there off the 5. In Ashland, and it's great because they always have really stinky hot dogs rolling that have been there for days. And the bathroom has two toilets, but no doors or stalls. So you just have to lock the main door.
Cool.
It's a great
fun fact.
If you're heading to LA, you know that one. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do.
And also there are, for people that do want to go to the Shakespeare thing, there are so many famous actors and performers that go there to be part
Cranston.
Of it.
I think Bryan Cranston.
Yeah, Bryan Cranston is a huge part of it.
It's a big, big festival.
John Lithgow, maybe?
I think so.
So
Sarah
many.
Paulson, maybe?
Yep.
Yeah.
So many. That's cool.
All right.
Yeah. Road trip.
For stinky hot dogs. That's so gross.
My favorite.
Alicia, sick. Of course, that's your memory of Ashland. A Shell station.
It had a notable toilet.
Dirty hot dogs.
It's not very long, but oh well.
Story of my life.
Story of my life. When the fuck my grammar.
Fuck your grandma.
No.
Oh.
Ashes. That him and Kelly would split the properly eat properly. Kelly would split the properly. Oh my God. I'm combining the two words like a silly little slut.
You little goose.
I'm a little minx. Which means she could be released from cocky. From cocky.
Hello. Who? I don't know. I'm with you on Josh. I'm with you.
I found an article of 20 of these knockoff Ninja Turtles.
Oh, wonderful.
I'm very excited. We'll talk about it later. Battletoads.
Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderinTheRain. And suck my balls.